This month's real composer is George Gershwin, and I'm delighted to have been joined by one of Gershwin's most celebrated exponents as a pianist and conductor, Andrew Litton. Andrew, thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
He is the prince who has taken Cinderella by the hand and openly proclaimed her a princess to an astonished world. That was Walter Damrosch describing Gershwin. I suppose his main claim to fame really is this bridge. Is it mythical or otherwise that he is the man who bridged the classical tradition with the popular? Do you think that's a justified claim?
Absolutely. And it's still the case, which is amazing for saying that George Gershwin died in 1937. That all those years ago, this man who only lived 38 years and didn't write that much music has made such an impact. There's scarcely a day that goes by on this planet when somebody's not playing Rhapsody in Blue or excerpt of Porgy and Bess or singing one of the fantastic songs that the Gershwin brothers wrote. So I think the impact of this composer is truly unique and extraordinary. What's that other great line, George Gershwin made a lady out of jazz?
Yes.
I think he actually crossed the borders between both genres so effortlessly. He definitely blurred the lines and also inspired, I think, if we look at the number of classical, or shall we say serious composers who suddenly then embraced jazz in their classical compositions. Of course, you know, the easy one is Maurice Ravel, because, you know, those wonderful piano works he wrote after getting to know George Gershwin. But there were so many other composers who were touched by this concept, and we really have Gershwin to thank for that.
I wonder where it came from, though. I mean, it's extraordinary that he's the youngest son of first-generation Russian Jewish immigrants living in Brooklyn with not a musical tradition in the family particularly. And in fact, I don't think Jacob, as he was originally named, was originally drawn to the piano because they bought an instrument for his elder brother Ira initially, and George was not terribly interested in it.
No, he was much more, as a lad, into sports and playing on the streets, stick hockey and getting into fights, and that was sort of his thing. And then I think one day he just sat down at the piano and something struck. He definitely had some sort of epiphany at that moment. And
I heard he'd heard a player piano in a shop playing Rubinstein's Melody in F.
Uh-huh.
And he just listened to it over and over again. And that was the sort of the stimulation. But, you know, the gift of melody on a Schubertian, Tchaikovskian level simply cannot be taught.
No, exactly. And that's where I think he's at his most special. This effortlessness with which he was able to have melodies appear throughout his compositional life, I think, is the most fascinating thing about Gershwin, and then the most unique, the most special. He goes up, you mentioned Schubert, but also with, say, Giuseppe Verdi, who seemingly also could just sit down and outpour these fantastic melodies. So a truly unique gift in that regard, and a very special. You'll almost only need to hear a Gershwin song once and you can sing it back. There's so few composers who can claim that.
That's absolutely true. But yet very early on, he's clearly an ambitious man because very soon he's taking lessons with some of the top New York teachers. I mean, Ernest Hutcheson was a very famous piano teacher, Charles Hambitt's own, and he studied harmony with Edward Kalenyi and Reuben Goldmark. This is a man who's very early decided that he's not just going to be a songwriter, he's going to go for greater things.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, they're the legends. I mean, who knows if they're really true, but of George going to Maurice Ravel and saying, please, can I study with you? And Ravel said, why be a second-rate Ravel when you're already a first-rate Gershwin?
Yes.
And then the other famous story with Igor Stravinsky, who was, you know, notorious at counting his money. Apparently, George Gershwin went up to Stravinsky and said, may I study with you, please? And Stravinsky said, how much money did you make last year? And when George Gershwin told him, he said, I think I should be studying with you. So, you know, who knows, like I say, if these are really true, but they do fit in with the characters of the specific parties involved.
Well,
so,
of course, Gershwin, very early on, had made a lot of money because before he was 20, I think he'd written La La Lucille, which is his first Broadway hit, which, of course, had his first big hit song, which he wrote with Irving Caesar, Swanee.
Thank you.
Andrew Litton. That sold more than a million copies in sheet music and apparently over 2 million records. I can't quite believe those are the figures. One song, that alone would have set him up for life, Swanee, Al Jolson.
That's right.
And that was by the time he was, well, as I said, before he was 20.
Yeah, it's incredible. All of that early success as well is what prompted, of course, the invitation from Paul Whiteman at the end of 1923 to commission George to write a piano concerto, which Gershwin was to play himself at a jazz retrospective concert, which is a wonderful euphemism because, you know, jazz hadn't been around long enough to deserve a retrospective. But this concert that Paul Whiteman was planning on, I think it was February 12th, 1924, Gershwin was thrilled, said absolutely, and then promptly forgot about it. And he was in Boston about 3 weeks before with Ira for out-of-town tryouts for, I believe the musical is called Sweet Little Devil. And Ira's reading the morning paper, and George is making some coffee. And Ira says, "Hey, George, your piano concerto is being premiered in 3 weeks." And George goes, "What piano concerto? Oh, my God." Well, I don't know what he said, but I'm sure it's not printable or certainly repeatable. But, of course, he calls Whiteman in a panic, saying, "I can't possibly write this concerto in 3 weeks. I haven't started yet." And Whiteman says, "You're going to, because you're my headliner. You know, you're my main event on the last part of the concert." So they reached a compromise. Whiteman threw in his legendary orchestrator, Ferdy Groffé, and basically said to George, "Look, just write something for the band to play. He'll orchestrate it, and you can improvise your parts as we go." And that's almost the way it went. I think it was a lot more fleshed out by that date in 1924. It wasn't just completely improvised, but...
There were definitely blank pages on the score on the first
night.
Yeah.
Exactly. Of course, then also the piece wasn't a concerto. It became this rhapsody, but... My favorite story of all is, of course, the birth of the famous glissando that opens Rhapsody in Blue, perhaps the most famous musical signature there is in history. Mm-hmm. And that was not by Gershwin either. It was an accident at rehearsal, which apparently was endless for this concert. The first clarinet of the Paul Whiteman band was a famous jazzer named Russ Gorman. He actually also came from the world of klezmer. And he saw this trill in a scale, and he went, "Oh, my goodness, again?" You know, another... He had this ability, like all klezmer clarinetists, of doing this smear of sliding up and down on the clarinet effortlessly, to the bane of every clarinetist ever since, because he did this smear instead of a scale. And George, who was sitting at the piano, jumped up from the piano bench and allegedly said, "That's it. That's fantastic. We keep that in," you know. And so every clarinetist ever since has been cursing Russ Gorman for coming up with this great idea.
Is it a tricky thing to play, then?
Very tricky. I mean, it's one of those things you can either do it or you can't.
Because on the Toscanini recording, of course, Benny Goodman messes it up, doesn't he? That's a famous example.
And I've sat on stage many a time when it sounded troubled on the way up. And if one listens, there indeed is the original cast, as it were, got together in June of 1924 and recorded a 9-minute version. You know, it's not the full Rhapsody in Blue, but it's 9 minutes worth. And one can actually hear Russ Gorman on that recording, and it's fantastic.
Part of Gershwin's original 1924 recording of Rhapsody in Blue with Paul Whiteman. Andrew, you've played the solo part from the keyboard, haven't you, many times?
Many times.
It's one of your showpieces.
Yeah, I'm in fact doing it several times this season that way. So, yeah, it's very much still part of my repertoire. I'm doing it in London in February, in fact.
But then you read about Leonard Bernstein writing about Rhapsody in Blue in 1955, said, "It's not a composition at all. It's a string of separate paragraphs stuck together with a thin paste of flour and water. I don't think there has been such an inspired melodist on this earth since Tchaikovsky, but if you want to speak of a composer, That's another matter. Gershwin had to put up with an awful lot of that sort of stuff in his life, didn't he?
Yeah. The irony is, all he wanted was to be taken seriously.
Yes.
He was desperate to be accepted in the classical world. But he made decisions, even near the end of his life, that contradicted that. For example, with Porgy and Bess, which Pace Leni is a fantastic piece and shows somebody who, even in his mid-30s, was very capable of future greatness. As far as we look at what Giuseppe Verdi was writing when he was 35 compared to what he was writing in his 50s and 60s, there's no comparison. You know, the man grew and developed. Gershwin, sadly, never was given that opportunity.
Having said that, though, it's only a year later that he writes the Piano Concerto, which is an enormous development, isn't it?
A year later from Rhapsody in Blue, yeah, absolutely. That was 1925. And that was the first piece he ever orchestrated himself.
Now, is that true?
Do you think that he actually orchestrated it?
Mm.
I don't know.
I just had my doubts that from zero with Rhapsody in Blue to 12 months later and reading a load of books about orchestration, he can bring up such a fabulously imaginative score as a Piano Concerto. It seems almost miraculous.
Well, and then even more amazing 3 years later, American in Paris,
which is
a wonderful tone poem, brilliantly written. I'm sure he had help, but I think he was enough of a serious person that he did put his hand to it. You know, whether he showed it to somebody who then said, no, you can't have the double basses do that. I'm sure he had counsel, but I do believe that he really did persevere and do this because he wanted to so badly.
Because he also hired 55 musicians a few weeks before the premiere of the Piano Concerto just to see if it sounded as he felt it was in his head. And he came out and said, yes, that's exactly what I heard.
Well, you know, rock stars today, of course, can do that. Just get together in a studio and here's my latest charts. Let's see what they sound like.
Not many musicians
can't do that in the classical world anymore.
Not many have the luxury of that, do they? But then that's another work that you play yourself and conduct from the keyboard. Yes, talk to me about the Piano Concerto, one of my favorites, I must say. And I think the most popular American concerto now.
Definitely. Well, listen, it's a piano concerto with a Charleston in it. You know, how much more do you have to say? What a fantastic idea, you know, to suddenly stick this Charleston tune in. Of course, 1925, that was all the rage.
Yes.
The most beautiful, soulful, bluesy second movement, a fast and furious last movement. It's just got every element one wants, really, in a concerto. Great, big, sweeping, romantic tune. And my biggest regret is that fantastic theme in the first movement is the piano never really gets to play it. You sort of tinkle along in an upper octave, you know, accompanying the orchestra, and then the orchestra takes over and just wails away in the best Hollywood tradition. That's why I love to play and conduct it, because I get the best of both worlds that way.
Yeah, but there again, our serious critical people, they took him to task. It was too influenced by Debussy. It was not really anything. It was too much Rachmaninoff. You know, people are always so ready to pull this man and others like him down?
It was something he was plagued with. And ironically, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. He goes out to Hollywood on two occasions, but the second time with his brother. And the Hollywood producers were very scared that this was the guy who wrote that opera, Porgy and Bess. What is he going to be able to write film music?
Yeah.
Of course, he was totally capable of writing film music, as he proved, writing some of the greatest songs he ever wrote for Shall We Dance, which was the second to last project before he died.
Mm-hmm.
So he could play both sides of the fence very easily, but he really, really wanted to be accepted as a serious composer. And I think he might have ultimately gotten there had he had more chance to keep writing in that style.
Well, An American in Paris, which you alluded to earlier, I mean, that really is the first truly American orchestral tone poem.
Certainly that hit the major leagues. Let's not forget that Charles Ives was writing lots of stuff way before this that never got played in his lifetime or until 50 years later.
Mm.
You know, and he was writing all sorts of extraordinary tone poem type things, Three Places in New England and Central Park in the Dark and, you know, all sorts of remarkable pieces, but nobody played them. So I think, yes, you're right that Gershwin was actually the first person to write something that got played all the time.
And captured the public imagination.
Exactly. And what a cinematographic piece that is. You know, it was only natural that it became a movie later, but you don't need the movie. You can see all of this happening as you play the piece. As I conduct the piece, I see the tourist walking out of his hotel, turning to the left and the right, not knowing quite which way to set off, and then, you know, off you go on your adventure.
Andrew Lisson conducting the Dallas Orchestra in part of An American in Paris. We should not pass by the Cuban Overture.
Oh, what a masterpiece. I would insist on performing it a lot more, but the problem is in these financially challenging times, it actually takes a huge percussion complement because you have four solo percussionists plus three in the orchestra, so you have to actually timpani plus seven. Most symphony orchestras carry two percussion or three, so you're hiring all these extra musicians, so orchestras are very reluctant to program it. And again, it falls into one of these strange gray areas. Is it a pop piece? Is it a classical piece? I think it's very much a classical piece that happens to have a rhythm section in it, you know.
Yes.
And it's just a brilliant work. Again, Gershwin influenced by foreign travel, just like he was with American in Paris. Trip to Cuba inspired this overture back in the days when, of course, travel to Cuba for Americans was very easy. And he brought back in his suitcase, just like he'd brought back the taxi horns from Paris for American in Paris, he brought back these Cuban percussion instruments. Claves, gourd, maracas, bongos. I wonder what customs thought when they opened his bag and saw these strange instruments. But anyway, that was the genesis for this overture. And in fact, if you look at the original manuscript, he actually wants these four percussionists to be at the front of the orchestra, which is completely impractical in most applications. But it was just a great idea.
He states it in the score. He wants them to stand.
Yes, and there's a little diagram that he drew. You know? Thank you.
Andrew, let's move on to the big one, because Porgy and Bess is his undisputed masterpiece. He'd written this very early one-act opera, early in his career, Blue Monday, which you can hear and see all the infelicities of a completely inexperienced dramatist and composer. That was back in 1922. But otherwise, there was no attempt at a serious opera between that and when he wrote Porgy. A masterpiece?
I think so, absolutely. I've had the great good fortune to be able to conduct it on several occasions complete. Is it long? Could it have used some editing? Would he have figured out some conventions later that would have perhaps worked better? Sure. I think these are undeniable. As I alluded to earlier, when we look at what somebody who we now think of as one of the greatest opera composers who ever lived, Giuseppe Verdi, and we look at what he was writing in his mid-30s compared with what he was writing 20 and 30 years later, there is no comparison. The man just grew and developed, and all these great ideas in the early operas became full-blown, fantastic ideas later and were effortlessly stitched together. The fascinating thing about Porgy and Bess is all the different genres that are exploited by the Gershwins musically in the opera. It's just this fantastic melting pot of musical ideas and styles and concepts. And I think there are several conventions that are incredibly powerful. The fact that only the people of color in the opera sing. The white people do not sing. They only speak. So many ideas that were so far ahead of their time as far as showing this kind of tension and divide that has been part of my country's history since day one. Really a piece so far ahead of its time in so many ways. And I think, like all people let loose in a toy store for the first time in their lives, maybe he put too many great ideas in one big pot. You know, it is a very long piece.
Well, that's a nice way of putting it. I remember when you were conducting it at Covent Garden, you told me that you had spotted something like 130 errors in the score. I've always been fascinated by that.
Part of the problem with that piece and so many things of Gershwin, just like has been so wonderfully done recently with William Walton, all the works need to be redone and printed properly with some sort of scholarly expertise. And one hopes that that will indeed happen. The parts to Porgy and Bess are fairly disgraceful, I have to say. And, you know, these days with all the computer technology available, it would be so easy to get a proper edition going of that opera. But that's neither here nor there. There are so many mistakes that go by in works of a popular nature because they're never rehearsed, so people never fix them. So I come along, and of course I want my four rehearsals on whatever it is, American in Paris, whatever. You wouldn't believe some of the stuff that you find.
Give me some examples.
When you dig
below. Because
I think
people, that's interesting, because I think people just suppose that there it is, that's the Bible, and that's how it is. But so what do you do when you spot a little, what is it, an F sharp in the bassoon which shouldn't be there, or that sort of thing?
Exactly, and it's always in those inner voices, instruments where these problems occur. There are at least 30 mistakes in the second clarinet, as I recall, second and the bass clarinet. Obvious, completely wrong harmonies. And sometimes when you find yourself in a situation like, well, look, here it is in the score, and of course that makes it into the parts, you need to do something as simple as go look at the vocal score, which of course is just piano reduction, which the composer would have been in charge of as well. And then you see, well, no, of course that's the harmony that's intended here. So very often you just have to use your head and go, this is clearly not an F sharp, clearly an F natural, whatever. But those are exactly the kinds of things. They're never obviously in the melody, which everybody can hear, you know, or in a bass line. They're always in the inner voices.
And do you find that orchestral musicians put up any objections to when the conductor comes along and says, sorry, you've been playing that wrong for the last 40 years?
No, I think they find it fascinating, actually. Sometimes I get, oh, I've always thought that sounded strange.
Ah, you know? Yes,
that's
yes.
Always nice.
Thank you.
Bess, You Is My Woman, from Andrew Lytton's own suite from Porgy and Bess. Not a huge hit when it first arrived. Again, people were puzzled that somebody from Broadway could write an opera, and then the opera people saying, well, no, he's a songwriter, and this usual confusion. As with all his major works, we have an eminent person from the music world, in this case, Virgil Thompson, writing that Porgy and Bess, the libretto should never have been accepted on a subject that should never have been chosen by a man who should never have attempted it. What is it about these guys?
Jeremy, don't ask me about critics, please. No, you're absolutely right. It's so tragic that people could really have missed the point so dramatically. But, you know, it's so funny how opinions are. You quoted Walter Damrosch at the beginning of this talk. He's the same person who, around the same time, wrote of Aaron Copland, if he keeps writing music like this, he'll be locked up in an asylum before long or something like that. That's a paraphrase. But, you know, so here he was praising Gershwin on one hand and saying that Copland was an axe murderer on another. It's an emotional art, and it, of course, strikes emotions and reactions in people differently. But with Porgy and Bess, the bottom line is he dared to go where no one had gone before racially and historically and also musically by combining all these incredible genres. I mean, at one point, there's even early rap, you know, in Mariah's Hates Your Struttin' Style. You know, that's rap, you know, back in 1935. Who would have thought it? So, you know, it's just a work of genius, I think. And yes, it's troubled, but it's so what? Get beyond that. One of the tactical errors, perhaps, that he made with Porgy and Bess was instead of going for the Met premiere, where it would have been done 7 or 8 times and that would have been it, they decided to put it on Broadway. And so, of course, there went the original concept of the opera down the tubes. They had to shorten it because it was now a Broadway show. And it's not a Broadway show. That's the problem with it. You know, there's absolutely no way that Porgy and Bess is a Broadway show unless you completely doctor it. So it's been so wonderful that in the 1990s, it started to be taken seriously on a worldwide level as an opera. And we started to see productions, you know, starting, of course, the infamous Trevor Nunn Glyndebourne. So that was a huge tactical mistake, I think, that the brothers made at that point. And that, of course, resulted in the piece not being regarded the way it should have been.
And who knows what he would have gone on to write had he not been taken from us so early. There were plans for a symphony, a string quartet, a ballet, and apparently a cantata based on the Gettysburg Address. One would like to have heard that. He was, as you said at the beginning, developing with every work that he wrote. One mystery remains for me about Gershwin, the private life. Yeah. There are lots of girls, lots of affairs, lots of names linked to and all that sort of stuff. Never married, never committed himself. I don't know if you've got any theories on that.
Everything I've read about him indicates somebody who, I think he got a lot out of just being himself. I don't know if he needed a partner. He was larger than life, filled the room with his ebullient personality, and I don't know whether it was just that he seemed to be attracted to women that were spoken for, so that made it taboo or impossible, or whether he just didn't feel a need to settle down, and whether that might have changed when he turned 40. Who knows? These are all conjecture. But the stories of him at parties where he'd sit at the piano and hold court all night, surrounded by women, I mean, there's certainly every opportunity imaginable that he had to find a partner. I just don't know whether that was what he needed.
And then we know he was taken from us at the age of 38 after an operation for, well, an inoperable brain tumor. Apparently, medically speaking, it was a gliomatous cyst in the right temporal lobe of the brain. Very tragic because for weeks beforehand, people had noticed he'd been very strange and walking around, and people had thought he was drunk. And then he himself said there was the strange sensation of burning rubber. Can you imagine?
No.
Nobody knew what it was like, and then he was rushed into hospital and too late.
One of the things that I did hear was that George was a bit of a hypochondriac, so when he was complaining about not feeling well, nobody took it terribly seriously. But the thing that I read when I was a kid that was, you know, if only they had operated sooner, has since been disproven, that apparently this was inoperable. It was only a question of time, sadly.
And the legacy is one of the, I suppose, wealthiest copyrights around at the moment, because the songs, the music we've been talking about and the opera are played, as you say, every day all over the world. Somebody once told me, I'm sure it's an exaggeration, but anyway, that the royalties that the Gershwin estate has collected over the years just from Summertime is equivalent to the Argentinian national debt.
That's beautiful.
One hopes it's true.
Absolutely. But you know what's also interesting? We've spoken a lot about what a tough road he had with the serious musicologists, the critics, really just being accepted by them. But yet, how extraordinary when we look at his circle of friends. I mean, he played tennis with Arnold Schoenberg. If Arnold Schoenberg could take this guy seriously, why couldn't anybody else? I was thinking about that earlier this morning. How extraordinary that must have been. You know, what did they talk about? Serial technique?